Perfect. All right. Okay. So we're coming to the end of the conference now, and this is sort of a little bit of a personal session for me because everyone out there probably, you know, some people are a lot younger than I am, obviously, and are kind of getting into the game industry, but, you know, I can remember when I first started working on games when I was very little. Obviously, there were a bunch of things that were kind of formative in, like, my experience of making games and, you know, being just a kid who was at home, you know, typing away on the home computer and whatever. I kind of think back to, like, what inspired me to do stuff or what were the games I played that were like, I really want to make that. And by far, the one that, like, comes to mind for me the most was Secret of Monkey Island, and this is true for a number of reasons. One of the reasons, obviously, is just because at that time, I mean, I think there's many, many people who consider that, like, one of the defining games of that time in gaming. But there was also the fact that as somebody who sort of knew a little programming but was pretty bad at it, looking at that game and looking at the other games that were in its category at that time, I could actually see the difference in craftsmanship on that one, like even at that time, because I remember, you know, right out of the box these things would ship and they would be like, you know, the Secret of Monkey Island game would be like this really fast, fluid experience and everything seemed to work great. And you would see like a, you know, year later or something, you'd play a similar game there and you'd try to do something like click to walk and it would wait a while and then the guy would kind of do this really weird path that didn't look anything right. And I was just like, even at that time, I was kind of like, wow, like this is so much better than this. And I don't even know why, and I'm not sure I could do this, but this is who I'd want to be, right? Like, I want to be the guy who makes Secret of Monkey Island, not the guy who makes this other game, right? And so when I was putting together the people who I most wanted to have here, my mind immediately went to that, and I was thinking, like, if Ron wants to come talk, that would be, like, the coolest thing ever, and I was kind of on the fence about it, because I'm like, well, I don't know, like, maybe he doesn't want to talk about that sort of stuff anymore, maybe he's not that interested in engine programming anymore, and so I go look at what he's doing, and he's actually writing, he said, because I thought Thimbleweed Park, like, oh, maybe he's, like, managing that process, and he's like, he's actually writing a new adventure game system from scratch himself now, right, and so I was like, this is perfect. So I can't wait to ask him the questions that I've got here and hear what he has to say. So please join me in welcoming one of my game development heroes, Ron Gilbert. So I have something just to prove that I'm not making this story up for crowd effect. I have here an original Secret of Monkey Island mouse pad that you gave me the first time I went to visit. You like had it in your office.
Yes, I had a stack of those.
I have kept it in like pristine condition. And my actual Secret of Monkey Island 2 box, which for some reason I still kept this as well. It even has the original DRM people right here, a decoder wheel. When was the last time you saw a game that needed a decoder wheel, right? They don't make them like they used to.
Back then, DRM was fun, right? It wasn't just something that was annoying. It was something you actually had fun with when you started the game.
They sort of thought about that process, I guess, a little bit more. How can we make this something that's not so so onerous, I guess? Whereas now these are like, look, you're just going to deal with it. There's nothing you can do about it.
Exactly. And you don't actually own it. You're just licensing it.
You rent it. Yeah. I would not be able to bring this today, would I?
No, you would. You'd be violating several trademark and copyright laws.
Well, okay, that's kind of scary. I probably shouldn't ask a follow-up question because I'll just get depressed. But I want to start out by just saying, can you take us back just a little bit to sort of start things off? I really want to know about, so Maniac Mansion was not a game I ever had, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, as a kid, you know, I didn't actually have all, you know, every game or anything. Like, nowadays, it's kind of crazy. When you're an adult and you have money, you can just get, if you want to see what Maniac Mansion, you just get it. But back then, you know, you only had certain games. So I never actually got to play Maniac Mansion, but that was kind of the start of the whole, you know, that's the whole adventure game, sort of like, I want to say, the sort of the genre that you pioneered, like that way of making
point-and-click games.
The point-and-click games. Mm-hmm. And so could you take us back to sort of like right before that, how does this start happening? Like, you know, what was your experience at that time? Why did you look at that and, you know, and say, I want to start making something like this? What, you know, and what was your sort of like skill set at the time that made you think like, I can, you know, I can do this better, or I want to go do this thing? So can you, just give us, set the stage.
Yeah, well, I was hired at Lucasfilm to do porting. They had built some games on the Atari 800, and they needed someone to port them to the Commodore 64. And that was primarily what I did, which is Commodore 64 programming. So I was hired to do port work. And I got there, and I became friends with Gary Winnick, who was an artist at Lucasfilm, but the only artist at Lucasfilm at the time.
There was just one artist? Group.
Yeah, Gary. Okay. He did all the art for all the games. He was the only artist there.
Just like at Ubisoft now.
And so he and I became really good friends, and eventually we became roommates, and we, you know, shared a place together. And we, you know, we wanted to make a game. And I, at the time, I kind of felt like, because I was a contractor at the time, I wasn't even an employee. And you know, I felt like, you know, I want to get a full-time job here. I mean, I was working at Lucasfilm, right, with Star Wars and George Lucas and, you know, all this stuff. It's like, I don't want to leave here. And so I thought, well, you know, maybe if I actually, you know, pitch a game and the game gets done, then I'll get hired on full-time and that'll be good. So Gary and I started talking about, you know, pitching a game. And we had this idea for this strange kind of, you know, comedy horror game with this weird family. And, you know, we talked about all sorts of ideas. And we had, like, no idea what the game was, right? We just had, we had a bunch of funny stuff. We had funny ideas. And that was all that we really had.
Okay.
And I think, you know, if I look back through my entire career, I think the thing that drives me creatively the most is fear, you know?
The second time that's been mentioned today.
And it's and it's like, when I get like terrified of something, it's like all these creative gears kick in, right?
Okay.
And so I was looking at all these great ideas that Gary and I had, and I had no idea what this game was. And I was just, I was afraid, you know? It's like this fear was kicking in. And we, Christmas break came, and we went on break, and I went down to, you know, to LA where my aunt and uncle live, and my 8-year-old cousin was there, and he had just gotten a, you know, Tandy computer, and he was playing King's Quest.
Okay.
I had never seen King's Quest before, right? I played Text Adventures, you know, Infocom and all that, but I'd never seen King's Quest before, and I watched him play this thing, and it just, everything just fell into place. It's like, this is what Maniac Mansion needs to be. It's an adventure game. So I came back after Christmas, just all energized, and that's when we just turned the whole thing into an adventure game at that point.
And so King's Quest obviously looks quite a bit different than Maniac Mansion, because it's kind of, you drive the character around, it's got a text parser, you know, you type in kind of the old Infocom style, so it's quite a different game. So when you came back having seen King's Quest, it didn't go like, oh, we'll just make King's Quest and we'll swap in our funny ideas and that's the game we're going to make. So how do we get from I saw King's Quest, which is actually pretty different, to... excuse me, to Maniac Mansion? Like, what did that process start looking like? What was the, did you start making a King's Quest clone right away and then start deviating from it, or did you iterate on it sort of like in a discussion first before you started making anything? Like, what, how did that happen?
Well, the big thing was that I had played a lot of text adventures, and I liked text adventures, but I really did hate the parsers, because I felt like I was always playing this game, which I called Second Guess the Parser.
Okay.
Is that I knew what this thing was, right? But did the game call it a bush? Was it a plant or a tree? I guess since we're talking about trees today.
Yeah.
You know, what was this thing? And, you know, maybe the designer had put in a bunch of synonyms or something, but maybe they didn't get the synonyms I wanted. And so I said, you know, it's like, I can see this stuff, I just want to touch it. I just want to click it. I want to say that's the thing I want to interact with. And so that's kind of where getting rid of the parser came from. You know, it's like, you know what, we should just get rid of the parser. And the fact is that, you know, even sophisticated adventure games probably only use like 5 or 6 verbs anyway, right?
Yeah.
They're all just synonyms for stuff. So we kind of went through and we picked out the verbs that we thought would be useful, and those, we just put them right on the screen. And so you just click on the verb and you click on the object. And that was kind of where the whole, you know, point and click thing came from.
Well, so how did you sort of do that process, though? Because, you know, Was that something that you thought of before you started programming the game? Or is that something that you sort of, like, did you start making a parser and then go, wait a minute, we could do this? Or did you, was this just like you came back from King's Quest and were talking to Gary and you guys just kind of figured this out before you even, like, started, really? Like, what was that like?
We knew we were dumping the parser and we knew we were going to the verb interface before I started programming.
So that was just already in your head from Infocom days, it just kind of clicked. When you saw King's Quest, you were like...
Yeah, we don't want to do that. And Lucasfilm had done a game previously called based on the movie Labyrinth.
Okay.
And they had done kind of a verb interface. It was like the spinning wheel thing.
Okay.
You know, it was very clunky and it was cumbersome, but you know, that was a leaping off point for us, right?
Okay.
So it didn't come from absolutely nothing. It kind of came a little bit from the Labyrinth stuff.
And so it was clear enough from that that's like, this could work if we just do it a little bit.
Yeah, let's just refine it and simplify it, and this will just be a much better way for people to interact with adventure games.
So now you've got this sort of idea. You're like, okay, we've got the idea sort of for the story and the sort of things that we want to have happen, and we kind of know that we're going to do like this verb interface sort of thing where you click on stuff. But there's still a tremendous amount of, like, you know, how do we build a game like this, right? Because my understanding there is you're coming at it never having, like, you didn't work on King's Quest, so you don't know what the internals of King's Quest look like. And unlike nowadays, you know, a game like King's Quest or something would be trivial to write or something like this, back then you're talking about, like, you know, it's cutting, like, things are cutting edge. Like, just having sprites move on a screen is, like, a whole thing.
Yeah. So pixels are cutting edge.
Yeah, pixels are cutting edge, right? And so what's your process now? How do you sit down and start approaching this problem? I guess we can maybe also ask a little bit, like, how did you get the game approved? Did you work on it in spare time? what happened there? Like, I guess we should say before we start asking.
You know, Lucasfilm back then, Lucasfilm Games, was a very magical place in some ways, right?
Okay.
By the time that we had pitched Maniac Mansion, there were like 15 people in the group. So it was very, very small. And, you know, I think we were very lucky because I don't think George Lucas knew he had a games division. And so we had all of this amazing autonomy to do, you know, whatever we really wanted to do. And there was really no official approval process. So the way it worked was you wrote, you know, little, you know, 1, 2, 3-page design documents, and we just passed them around, right, on paper, and everybody took notes. And then things just kind of bubbled up until everybody said, hey, this is really interesting. And then they kind of became projects at that point.
So it was sort of like a collaborative buy-in sort of a thing, where it's like, if everyone sort of starts to think that this paper is one we should go with, then we will.
Yeah, okay. Exactly. So there was no real pitch to the whole thing.
And so did you start making the game before that, or did you start by making that document go, like, you and Gary go, okay, we're going to start trying to pitch it internally. Was that the first step then?
Yeah, it was floating that design document around and getting support for it, which is, you know, where the verb interface came from, was kind of, you know,
making
that
document.
Yeah, but that was probably like maybe a two-month process of pitching that around. And then, you know, in typical fashion from a couple of guys that have no idea what they're doing, we just jumped right into it. Right?
Okay.
Gary just started drawing art and I just started writing code and we had no idea where we were going really with stuff. And, you know, and I think, you know, that's really kind of where the whole Scum system came from, the adventure game system, because, you know, we took this path where I was just going to write this whole game in 6502 assembly language.
Okay.
Right? I mean, how hard can that be, right?
How hard?
So I just started kind of doing that. And, you know, again, that fear kicked in as I realized I'm just totally in over my head with this. There's no way we're going to be able to get this done, which is where doing, you know, a scripting language, you know, interpreted language, you know, kind of came from all of that.
Okay, so that actually sets up, like, perfectly the stuff I want to talk about there.
That's all on you.
A professional.
Yeah, give you a nice segue.
So looking at that process, right, you sit down and you're kind of going like, okay, we've got to start with some basic stuff. We've got to put some sprites on the screen. Mm-hmm. And presumably, like, LucasArts maybe already has some stuff. You said Gary could start drawing art for it immediately. Mm-hmm. Presumably there's some kind of pixel editing thing he can do or whatever. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of making some assets and maybe you're getting some stuff on the screen. At what point, how do you sit down and start that process? Because the part I'm kind of interested in is you know, nowadays, if I said, I need to sit down and make a point-and-click adventure game, I know what that is. Right. And I know exactly how it's going to run. So I can sit down and debate a bunch of design decisions in my head or something, or start typing or whatever, and maybe follow John's approach and say, I'll just write the simplest thing. But in this case, we don't even know what it is yet at all, right?
It's a new genre.
It's a new genre. So what literally, like, if you can remember, I know this is kind of a weird part of the development process. I can't even remember stuff I wrote in stream last week, so I realize it's hard. But what do you actually sit down and start with? Like, what was the thing that we just started doing? Can you give us any insight into that? Because I'm really curious.
Well, I knew that the structure of the game was going to kind of be based on these rooms. We called them rooms and objects.
Okay. Right?
Those are the two things: rooms, objects, and actors.
Right? Okay.
Those are the three things that made it up. Okay. So I kind of knew that I had to do that. I knew that objects had to appear in rooms. I knew I needed some system to be able to tag objects, so when you touched them with the cursor and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Okay.
I knew that stuff.
Okay.
You know, in terms of the language itself, you know, I really didn't have idea what the language was going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd kind of heard about Lisp, and I guess, you know, people were using Lisp for AI stuff, and I thought, okay, well, this, I should probably use Lisp.
Okay.
So, you know, my language looked very Lisp-like with lots of, you know, parentheses and all that stuff on it. And I very quickly just ditched all that.
Okay.
And I went to something that was a little more C-like, you know, with like curly braces and stuff that was, I think, a little more saner for
Well, how did you make the decision? So, because this is actually an interesting part, too. So when you start working on this thing and you start coding up the actors, that sort of thing, that's sort of part of it, I guess you could start in 6502, right? You could just start making the hard-coded versions, but I guess is what you're saying. You actually started hard-coding them initially.
Mm-hmm.
How did you first come to, you said fear, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
How did you first make that leap of, like, you know what, if I had an interpreted thing here, this would work? Because that's not, again, now that might be an obvious decision, because maybe you have awareness of all these things, but at that time, that is not an obvious thing to think of necessarily. Mm-hmm. Had you seen other games do this? Did you have some experience in the past that made you think this would be a good idea? Like, how did that thought come in?
Yeah, that came from a guy named Chip Morningstar, and he worked at Lucasfilm. And he and another person at Lucasfilm named Randy Farmer, they went on to create Habitat, which is probably the world's first graphical MMO.
I remember that.
And I mean, Chip was just like an uber smart guy.
Okay.
And you know, I was just kind of talking to him about the whole problem, and he just kind of said, "Hey, why don't you do a scripting language?"
Okay.
It was just something he threw out there. Why don't you do a scripting language?
So he just knew about it from some other situation.
I mean, I mean, you know, at the time, Infocom had a scripting language, right? I mean, they didn't code their stuff, and, you know, Sierra had one as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it wasn't something that was totally unheard of before. But, you know, getting a whole, you know, compiled scripting language working on a Commodore 64, you know, there's 64K of memory in this machine, right?
Yeah.
And so that was, you know, that was something that I went really on a Commodore. You know, that I think that was the leap I had to make, was building a whole interpreted language that ran on this little 64K machine. You know, I kind of had to convince myself a little bit that
was
possible.
A good idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and so in deciding to take that step, was really what you were thinking there is like, okay, if we had a scripting language, it will be easier for me to script, or was that more of a decision like, if we had a scripting language, other people could start tweaking the look, which, because later on it probably that thing changed, but in Maniac Mansion, what was that decision?
Yeah,
like?
In Maniac Mansion, you know, I was very idealistic,
you
know, at the time, and, you know, I kind of thought, you know, I'm going to build this scripting language that's so natural, you don't even have to be a programmer. Right?
Okay.
That I can hire like writers,
right,
and they can come and they can use my scripting language and they can build these games because this thing is just so brilliant, you know, that it's not even like programming.
They just describe the game and
it
just
and
creates
it just
itself.
Understands it, right? You know, and how hard can that be, right? And
I'm so, at Commodore 64, plenty of horsepower.
You know, so I mean, that was kind of my initial thing, and if you look at the Scum language, you know, the commands in it are very verbose.
Okay.
Because I was trying to make things be very clear about what was happening with stuff.
So you kind of want to look very English-like.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and so a lot of the commands in the language are kind of like that. But I mean, at some level, you just can't get over the fact that whoever is doing this needs to understand basic logic, right?
Yeah.
They have to understand, you know, if then statements and all of this stuff that goes on. And there's just no way around that kind of stuff. So, you know, the language can be kind of verbose and, you know, English-like and very freeform in its structure. You know, you didn't pass a bunch of anonymous parameters to functions. You know, instead you said actor at, and then you could just put costume this, and just, you know, run on all of your stuff across it. So
gotcha.
You know, that's why it was kind of a verbose language, and it didn't look very programmery.
Now, you're gonna make this scripting language for the game. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, nowadays it's like, oh well, you know, we're gonna type the script in the script window, and mm-hmm. then it's the game's running, and we'll just alt tab between them, or they're on the same screen, or my multi-monitor, right? But we're talking about a Commodore 64 situation here. So, how does that what did that process look like at the time too? Because now you're like, okay, how are people making these scripts, and how does the turnaround time look like? And I think, like, again, it may not be that relevant to the programming of it so much, but it's kind of interesting just to think back about mm-hmm. how constrained that was. How did that process go? Like, what was that like at the time?
Well, we had a wonderful development environment.
Really?
And the Lucasfilm Games Group was kind of spun off or a part of the Lucasfilm Computer Division, which later changed their name to Pixar.
Oh, okay. So
all those people, you know, they all kind of worked in our group, and so we had these like really, really smart people, and you know, Lucasfilm, the whole entire company ran on these big mainframe, you know, VAX machines, you know, Unix machines, and everything. And one of the things they did was they built these little things that literally plugged my Commodore 64 into the VAX Unix machine.
Really?
I would plug the thing in, and then I worked on a Unix terminal on my desk, and I had complete control of the Commodore 64. I could pause it, I could download stuff to it, I could upload stuff from it. So I never programmed on the Commodore 64. It was all done on these big Unix machines.
I had no idea.
Which was very useful because Scum was a compiled language.
Yes.
And so the compiler ran on the Unix machines. It didn't run on the Commodore 64. So the whole compiler and the ARC pipeline and all that stuff just happened on the Unix machines, and then we just download everything in the Commodore 64. And it was nice because we could do a lot of hot loading stuff, right? We could just run things down to the machine, you know, while it was running. And this was, you know, in 1986, right? And that was very,
crazy.
Very, very different. You know, it's a lot like it is today, but very, very different than what was happening back then.
Yeah, that's actually incredible. So does that mean that somebody who was working on a particular room for the game could literally have a Unix thing open, modify some scripts, and in a relatively short period of time see the result?
Almost instantly.
That's insane.
Almost
Ron.
Instantly.
That is insane.
Yeah, because we would just push the script down. And the other thing about the Scum system was, you know, the Commodore 64 had 64K of memory, right? But a lot of that was taking up with the program.
Yeah.
And, you know, I actually had only 19K of memory free for all the assets in the game.
Okay.
And so, you know, what I had done was I wrote, actually Chip had written it because he was starting to work on Habitat at that time. So he wrote this wonderful memory management system where, you know, all the assets in the game were kept on this little heap.
Okay.
And the system was smart enough to understand that, okay, this stuff's old, no one's using it, flush it out. And if I bring in new stuff, just spool the stuff out of memory while the new stuff is brought in, right? This is on a Commodore 64, right? That all this stuff is happening. So, you know, the whole game is just kind of, you know, almost open world continuously playing while stuff is just spooled in from the disks.
Okay.
And so it made the debugging very easy on the from the Unix theme because we had all these assets, whether they were art or scripts. We could just pump a new one down to the heap, and it would just work right there on the thing. So it was a very, very quick development.
So you literally, on the Commodore 64, running on the Commodore 64, had hot loadable assets during, without restart.
Yes.
It just keeps running, and you could swap like the guy with a new bitmap.
Yeah.
That's kind of crazy. I don't even know. All right. I have trouble getting that working today on my machine.
Yes, yes. We did have to kind of enter the room you were in, right? So it wasn't just magical. We had to do a quick reload. But
I'll give that one to you.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, so I guess scripting language-wise, how did you approach that problem? I guess I should keep track of time because I kind of wanted to talk about two things. It looks like we have plenty, so we're good. So tell me a little bit about how you approached the scripting language problem, because like you said, if that was something that sort of someone said, hey, why don't you do a scripting language? You're like, oh, maybe that's a good idea. How did you know, I mean, even how to build such a thing, right? Did you have some experience with scripting languages? Did you like go get learn scripting languages in 20, 31 days or whatever it is? I'm sure that was a popular book at the time. Like, did you, like, how did you even know how to build one? Because, you know, again, back then, we take it for granted now that if I want to learn how to scripting, I type it into Google, how do I build a scripting language, right. And there's some tutorial. That's not the case. So what did that look like?
Well, that looked like a couple of things. When, before I got my job at Lucasfilm, back when I was in, high school, I got a Commodore 64.
Okay.
You know? So that was, you know, I'd learned programming on the Commodore PETs and some other stuff, but the Commodore 64, I got one of those, and I just thought this was, you know, an amazing device. But the one problem I had with the Commodore 64 is it had really great graphics, had wonderful, you know, SID chip for doing audio. None of that was accessible from BASIC.
Right.
On a bit of it.
Right.
Right. If you wanted to access that stuff, you did like peek and poke commands, you know, to hit the memory. It was just super, super cumbersome.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought it would really be nice if there was actually a BASIC language on the Commodore 64 that could take advantage of all these graphics, right? And one of the things I realized when I was hacking around with the machine is there's like 20K of ROM in the Commodore 64 where the BASIC interpreter sits, but there's 64K of RAM. So you bank out the ROM, and then you have 64K of RAM to play with, like if you don't need the BASIC interpreter.
Okay, so basically, normally the 64K, when the machine starts up, the 20K of ROM actually gets moved into the 64K of memory?
No, the ROM actually sits right above it,
above
in the
it.
Same
okay.
address
okay.
space. But what I kind of realized was that if I read a byte out of the ROM, and then I wrote it back to the ROM, it actually wrote to the RAM underneath. So what I did was I went through and I copied all of the BASIC ROM, writing it right back out to itself, banked out the ROM. Now I had the entire BASIC interpreter in RAM.
And you can modify it.
And so I started playing with it, and I built this whole extension to the BASIC language called Graphics BASIC.
Okay.
And it added sprite commands and line commands and sound commands. And I think it's kind of where my love of languages
came
started.
From.
Yeah. And so when I started doing the SCUM stuff, I kind of had this whole experience with Graphics BASIC, you know, of what a language looks like and how, you know, I understood how BASIC interpreted the language because I'd hacked into the whole thing and figured it all out. So when I was working on the SCUM system, I knew, you know, what it was like to go through and, the, you know, interpret opcodes and all that kind of stuff. That I had already figured out.
Yeah. Okay, so basically your experience with essentially disassembling BASIC, I guess we would call
which
it,
which I
right?
did. I printed out the entire BASIC ROM.
Okay.
You know, I remember sitting on my bedroom floor with these giant printouts and a pencil, you know, writing comments because, I mean, there was, it was not, there would, there were no comments, right? It was just assembly code.
And so from that, you learned how they had done their interpreter, and so now you knew, here's how I can make an interpreter.
Right.
That's amazing.
Yes.
Okay. So, okay. So you sit down to make the SCUM version of the interpreter, and you're just like, okay, so I'm kind of going to pattern after what I learned from BASIC, and we're going to, you know, we have the Unix terminal, so we're going to make the stuff that compiles down. Mm-hmm. How, you know, how long does that take to get working? Like, when does that start to come online? Like, how much of a process was that?
That took quite a while.
It
probably took me about a year from the point that we started working on it till we had a system that we were actually building a game in.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, I know this isn't actually true, but it feels like I almost got fired.
Okay.
I mean, I definitely remember being called into my boss's office and having a talk about how long Maniac Mansion is taking and is this thing ever gonna turn into something.
Okay.
So it was definitely taking a long time. And that was just pure inexperience, you know, at building, you know, what we were trying to build.
To build, well, sure. And it's very ambitious for the time, it sounds like. The hooking it up to a VAX machine is not something I think most people are doing either. But.
No.
So I want to take, just before I move on, because I want to talk a little bit about what you're doing now as well. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to ask one other question kind of to set that up a little bit, which is that one of the things that I mentioned kind of in the introduction as well is that one thing I noticed about the LucasArts games kind of right from the very beginning. So I, like I said, didn't ever have a chance to play Maniac Mansion, but certainly in Secret of Monkey Island and in everything that sort of came after it until, I don't know, maybe something like Grim Fandango where they went back to maybe like direct control. I felt like the click-to-move implementation in those games was much better than everyone else's click-to-move implementation. Maybe that's just complete misinterpretation of what I saw, but...
No, you're right.
But I wanted to ask about that problem specifically. Mm-hmm. So at some point, and I guess I don't know what this point was, but at some point you decided, I don't want to drive this guy around, I want to just be able to click to move right. him. Now, was that something you decided early on or late on?
That was early on. That was a part of the whole point and click interface, was we just wanted to touch everything. We didn't have a mouse. The Commodore 64
was
joystick.
Yeah.
But, you know, we knew we wanted to move the cursor around, and everything was just clicking on the screen. You click to walk, you click to interact.
So that original design document either includes, or when we were making it, we already had thought of, we don't really want you to drive this guy. We want you to click. Okay. Mm-hmm. Which I guess makes sense, because if I already have to be clicking on the menu things, what am I driving with?
Exactly.
I can't. And so it's kind of forces the issue almost. Mm-hmm. So you have to approach this problem now. It's like, okay, this is actually quite different than basically anything that I see at games at that time. Mm-hmm. All other games are pretty much direct control, whether it's an arcade game or a Sierra game, you're driving the guy around. So how did you approach that problem initially? Was it a big deal for you, or was it something you just did? Like, what was the mindset there, and how did that go?
Well, the issue is obviously pathfinding,
yes.
right? Is, I wanted to be able to click anywhere on the screen, and I wanted the character to figure out how to get there.
Yes.
Right? If it was possible for the character to walk from point A to point B, and he had to walk around a table and between some chairs and you know, around the lamp, I wanted him to do that. Yeah. Right. I didn't want him to walk in a straight line and get stuck, you know, against the dining room table
as
you walk around the table. So that became, a pathfinding issue. And, you know, I don't exactly remember kind of the genesis of, you know, how it all came about. But we used a system which we called walk boxes.
Okay.
And what it was, you know, if you think about the room, it's kind of a flat, but think about the floor of the room.
Yeah.
And I would just put these boxes, and they were literally squares, right? Because we didn't have the CPU power to even have angled lines and figure out, you know, the intersection.
So some kind of rectangle.
So they were boxes, you know, the walk boxes. And I would just put them on the floor, as many of them as I needed, and, you know, make sure that there was an overlap, you know, on them of the lines.
Okay, so all of the rectangles are slightly overlapping. Is that what you mean?
They share a pixel in common.
So exactly overlap.
Exactly
they
overlapping.
They osculate at this point, if you will. Okay. All right. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so you have all these boxes that litter the floor about where you can walk. Now, the hard part is, like, well, how do you path through them, right? And today, I mean, you just don't worry about it, right? You do some A-star thing or you know, whatever it is. But you just didn't have the CPU on a 0.8, you know, megahertz, you know, 6502. So, you know, the idea that it came up with is you just do a lot of pre-processing on it. And so I had all the boxes. There was like box 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Okay.
And I had this two-dimensional grid. And you look at the box you were in, so you were in box 1.
Okay.
You wanted to go to box 8.
Okay.
So you look up in the grid, you know, box 1, I want to go to box 8. And that number right there was the next box you want to walk into.
Okay.
Okay. So then I knew those connected. They had to.
Right.
So then it was very easy to find the connecting line, and then I would just walk to the center point of the next box.
So that's like Dijkstra's algorithm. Did you know that
at all?
So you full on just figured it out yourself?
Not at all.
And, of course not.
And that little matrix,
and
that was something that we had to build by hand.
Okay.
Right? That wasn't pre-processed. We'd lay down all the boxes
and then we'd type them into
the text editor, and we'd lay out that little grid of where you could go. So it was kind of a cumbersome process to set up walk boxes.
But the end result in the game is instant movement.
Yeah, exactly.
So basically, you would click somewhere. Mm-hmm. It would know that's in, well, first of all, it would just look to see through all the boxes. If it's any of these boxes, if it's not in a box, you're not going to go there. Right. Mm-hmm. Or did it try to go as far, close as it could?
It tried to go as close
so
as it could.
So how did that work? Did you just find the closest box?
It was a vertical line.
Okay, so it basically said, like, keep searching until we get to something.
Until you get a box, yeah.
So I find a box there, and then I basically set some global, you know, not global, but some state for this actor that's like, this actor is trying to go to box blah. Mm-hmm. So every time his box, you know, every time I update his movement, I go, what box is he in? Mm-hmm. figure out the direction to the next box and go. Well, how were you encoding stuff like that? Like what direction go from box to box?
It was really just straight lines.
Okay.
And you know, you had to be careful on your boxes because I knew that what the actor was gonna do was go from the point they were standing to the midpoint of where the two boxes intersected.
Okay.
And so I just kind of had to make sure. I mean, sometimes you know we'd have to put a couple of extra boxes in just to make
it look
feel
a little bit better.
You know feel right. But it was, I mean, it was pretty brain dead. You know what I was trying to do.
That's like a mystery that I've wanted to know for I guess what 30 years now. So thank you very much.
Yeah, it became a little more sophisticated. You know, by the time Monkey Island rolled around, we could do trapezoids.
Okay, so just to make less boxes so they
could
fit.
Yeah, so we could do like trapezoids and stuff. And, you know, it slowly evolved over time.
So let's jump forward now to Thimbleweed Park, right? And you're going to, this is the only question I think that I've asked you beforehand, so I kind of a little bit know the first answer, but everything else I don't know. So you're going to make another adventure game. And obviously, like, I mean, To drastically exaggerate, if you wanted to, you could literally go get someone's re-implementation of your thing, which is probably in the public domain now
Scum VM.
Some Scum VM you could use. So when you sat down to make a new adventure game in like, what, was it 2014 or 2013? 2014?
December last year,
okay. Mm-hmm. So 2014, you're like, I'm going to make a new one. Mm-hmm. How did that decision, like, what was the motivator for that decision?
The motivator was, again, it was Gary Winnick, and he and I were just talking one day about adventure games, and we were talking about modern adventure games, you know, versus kind of the old classic point-and-click games, and it really kind of, you know, it felt to me that adventure games have lost that charm that they had back then,
and
I really wasn't sure why they had, but it just felt like they kind of lost that charm, and so Gary and I were talking about you know, what that was. You know, maybe it was just our innocence of the time. Maybe it was that it was a brand new genre and it was just magical. And it was just not anymore.
When you said that charm, you don't really even know what it
was. I don't know what that
is. You're just like, I felt like there was a charm here and that charm is definitely gone.
Yeah, I have no idea what that is.
Okay.
And, you know, we were just kind of talking about that and we didn't really know what it was. And, you know, we started talking about, well, we should just make a new one.
Yeah.
We should just make one exactly like we made them back then, with the same sensibilities, the same, you know, kind of art style, everything, and just see if we could capture that charm. Yeah. Or maybe that charm has just been lost to time, you know, in some way. And, you know, so one thing led to another, and we decided to do a Kickstarter for it.
Okay.
You know, Kickstarters kind of based on nostalgia tend to do very well.
Yes,
you
that's
know?
True.
So, you know, we figured, well, we've got kind of a perfect know, opportunity to do this. So, you know, we just did a Kickstarter on it, which was successful. And we really have approached the game very much as, let's just pretend we were back in 1987 and we're making a point and click game.
Okay.
Let's just use all the same, you know, ideas that we had back then and see if we can somehow, you know, recapture that charm in kind of the way we design it and the way we build it, the way we kind of think about the game.
And so building a new system for it is kind of part of that whole mentality. Would that be an accurate statement? Meaning like, we want to create a new VM, for example, because that's what we did, and we're going to do that again.
I mean, it wasn't specifically that. I mean, I did spend a little time looking at current adventure game engines to see if any of them, you know, would do what I needed.
Okay.
And I mean, I very quickly discarded that. And
I think
most of it is. I mean, I love building game engines, right?
Okay.
I mean, I kind of think in some ways, when I design a game, it's really just an excuse to build a game engine. You know, that's all it really is, right? And so, you know, I think a part of that kind of recapturing everything was, you know, it's like what we kind of promised to the Kickstarter backers was, you know, they can relive playing a classic adventure game again, kind of like, you know, that there was this game we made back in 1987 that had just been discovered, right? That they can relive it. But I think in a lot of ways it was more about us being able to relive making the classic game again. And, you know, I do love making, you know, game engines and adventure game engines and that kind of stuff. So that became a very enjoyable part of the whole process for me.
And so when you started building, you know, this engine for the new game, what, like, and I guess it's a little bit difficult, like I said, you know, I want to make sure I don't go too far over time or anything, but like, approaching that, obviously there's a bunch of stuff that gets learned before this, I'm sorry, after the stuff of Maniac Mansion, right? Because you went through Secret Monkey Island, Secret Monkey Island 2, and obviously there's other people also doing games like, you know, Fate of Atlantis or something that are using your system. So the system itself is kind of growing and evolving. So obviously what you just described and, you know, like you said, triangular walk boxes, or sorry, trapezoidal walk boxes, et cetera, basically, like, you know, from wherever that sort of ended and wherever your thinking process ended, and I guess maybe at Humongous, you maybe would have revisited a bunch of design ideas for internals there. From that, starting out now, is what you're building similar to the last thing you built at, say, Humongous or something? I don't know if that's the most current, if that was like the most current architectural thinking that you've done on the problem or whatever. How similar is it, would you say? Like, how much is the same and how much of it's different? Like, what's the, give me a little idea there.
It's fairly similar.
Okay.
You know, I wanted the structure of the language to feel a lot like, you know, the structure that the Scum system had, the way rooms were laid out and objects were laid out and objects had verbs and the way that the code for the verbs was embedded in the objects. All that stuff, I felt worked really well for an adventure game. So I definitely replicated, you know, all of that in the new system.
So I'm interested in one thing you said there. The code for the verbs is embedded in the objects. So that means that when someone's designing something, they design the... I guess unpack that statement for those of us who don't know.
Yeah, it's like, well, if you look at the code, right, you would you know, object, and then you define an object, like object, you know, front door, right, and then a little curly brace, and then you'd have, you know, the name of the object, and some flags for the object, and local variables for the object.
Yeah.
Then inside of that, you would then have a statement that says verb open, curly brace, and a bunch of code and a close brace. So that was the code that got run when you opened the object.
Okay.
That code got run. And, you know, that just always kind of made a lot of sense to me, you know,
so
in terms of structuring.
It's sort of, it's its own, it's like a literal object-oriented programming. Like, we literally have objects, and they literally do encode the things they can do in reality in this game, right, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so that's kind of just the general idea when the designer or scripter, whoever's coming in to do this particular implementation, they think in terms of objects more in isolation in that way. And is that so that you can make multiple, is it the standard, maybe object-oriented, like, I guess, approach there, where it's like, the idea is that I can just code one door and stamp them down, or like, why do you like that, I guess? What was the benefit to that?
Well, I like that idea because it focuses kind of the function of the thing in one place.
Okay.
Right? If there's a door, or there's a key, or there's a, you know, rubber chicken, or whatever, it just keeps everything compact together.
Okay.
That this is the rubber chicken with the pulley in the middle object.
Right.
These are all the things that you can do with the object, and the code is just right there, close, you know, to what the object is.
So it's basically like an organizational technique, if you will. It's like, so at some level, it doesn't actually matter whether the thing's embedded in this or not, but what does matter is I kind of want to know object, all the things it can do, because that's like sort of the way I want to look at this game thing.
Right.
Exactly. Does that become, like, are there problems there? Because, like, thinking about, like, regular kind of code, and maybe this doesn't happen as much in adventure games, but, like, in regular code, you end up with problems where it's sort of the interaction between the objects is the complex part, and so it's difficult to sort of partition it off into separate things.
Right.
Is that not really a problem in adventure games, or it is? And then I guess I'd ask that question.
It's a problem.
Okay.
I mean, you know, you're using objects with other objects in adventure games. You know, you're using key with the door, right? And so, you know, you do have, you know, the door object and the key object, and at some point, you know, one of the two's use verb is going to get called, and it's going to pass the, you know, the key into the door's use verb. So you do, you know, you do have to deal with that,
that
kind
sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you do.
All right. But that, on the whole, isn't the, like, I guess what I'm saying is you're not so concerned about seeing the code organized that way, like pairs of objects, because that's the less common case, I guess? Is that the...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think about things as the object.
Okay.
There is the object, and what can the object do,
and
all the functions that the object can do.
And
this was before object-oriented programming. Right? I mean, I knew, I mean, I don't think C++ was anything more than a preprocessor
at that
point, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I didn't know anything about that. That was just kind of the way that I really thought about the verbs. Yeah.
So, you know, working on the new game, Was there any big, like, and maybe the answer to this is no, because I guess you did have a lot of time to refine it since, you know, you actually did two whole companies worth, I guess, right? You did the mm-hmm. Lucasfilm ones and the Humongous ones, which mm-hmm. both had an interpreter. Well, I guess it's Scum both times, but it's like you're evolved Scum. Mm-hmm. You're evolved Scum. I don't know what that is. This is some Scum I've been evolving. Here it is. It's wonderful. So was there anything that you sat down on like the VM side of things or the scripting side of things? Was there anything that you went into it going, you know, yes, I've done this a billion times, but I really, this time, I kind of want to solve problem X. We never got it. Mm-hmm. Like, was there anything like that that you sat down thinking about, or was it always just like, no, like, I was pretty happy with where we ended up, you know, at sort of like maybe at the end of the Humongous titles. Mm-hmm. I feel like I got most of the problems I want solved, or was mm-hmm. there some things that you're just like, this time, I'm not going to have problem X, or this time, I'm going to fix this thing that always bothered me? Does that make sense as a question?
I don't think there was a big thing. Again, you know, I was trying to replicate those classic games, and I knew exactly what I needed to do that, and I really did feel that the Scum language did what it needed to do with that stuff. I mean, there's, you know, the Scum language was compiled, so, you know, you'd make changes and you run a compiler, and it would compile it, and then you'd upload it. You know, now the compilation just happens in the engine at runtime. Right, so you know, there's a bunch of steps that have kind of been removed. You know, I no longer need a heap because I basically have infinite memory, to work with. So there's a bunch of things that are just simpler, to deal with. But I always liked the structure. I liked the way the multitasking worked on Scum. I replicated all of that. It worked for me. So
how did the multitasking work in Scum?
Well, the multitasking. On Scum, there were basically scripts, which were analogous to functions.
Right.
And when you...
And this is like what you were saying in the door, if I have door open, mm-hmm. there's some code in here. Right. That would be sort of the type of thing we would be talking about?
Yeah.
So that's going to execute in the Scum VM.
Right. And but the thing that I wanted to do with the Scum system was I wanted the objects to be, a little bit self-contained.
Okay.
Like if, the clock... needed to tick and it needed to move its little pendulum.
Yeah.
I just wanted to have a little piece of code that just moved the pendulum. Right. I didn't want to have a big state engine that you jumped into and had to spawn out to all the different pieces for something.
I
just wanted a little function. So one of the coolest things to me was the Scum system had a do loop that had no until or while on it.
Okay.
It was just do, open brace, close brace, and it would just run like that. And so that script would just sit there and do whatever it needed to do, and you could spawn off all of these different scripts for all these different objects and really let the objects deal with themselves in a way.
And how did you deal, I mean, I guess for the most part, in most circumstances you're describing, these do loops, I would know that I wouldn't have to execute one if I'm not in the room with that object, but I would imagine sometimes maybe I even do. And so like, how do you manage the fact that we could have tons of objects doing do loops, and which ones do I do now? Like what did that sort of look like, I guess? Is that...
Well, there were two kinds of functions. There were global functions and local functions.
Okay.
Local functions were local to the room.
Okay.
So when you left the room, all of the threads running that were local functions just got killed.
Killed.
Right? So you didn't have to manage that. So only the global functions were the ones that would, spin outside the rooms.
And objects could implement global functions or local functions inside them.
Yeah,
so you kind of just say this is something that has to happen all the time, or this is something that only happens when you're in the room with this particular object or whatever.
Yeah, like the clock ticking, you only care about that thread running
if
the clock is there. Where another function that's maybe waiting for the shopkeeper to get back from looking for the swordmaster, that's got to be a global function that sits there and runs.
I see. Mm-hmm. So, all right. So, taking the example that I asked before with the walk system, right, the walk box and so on. So, tell me a little bit about your approach to that now, right? Because, like, again, at the time, like we were saying, like, okay, I got to make all the boxes, and then we by hand put in like the thing. By the time you had gotten to, say, the maybe the end of the LucasArts, so let's say Monkey Island 2, were you still manually entering in the walk paths, or did you already kind of...
No, we were still manually entering those.
So how about End of Humongous?
We didn't have walk boxes in Humongous.
Oh.
Yeah, because the characters in the Humongous games,
yeah.
they didn't really kind of walk around the rooms in the same way.
I guess they kind of animated
yeah,
to
they
different
were, they,
stations.
Yeah, or, they were okay. they were more animated stuff, so they didn't really have to pathfind in
okay.
the same way.
So now, in this game, like I've even seen the videos of Thimbleweed Park with you walking the character around, so obviously it is pathfinding.
Yes,
so,
we have walk boxes.
Oh, really? Okay,
yes.
So what did you set it up? Still do walk boxes? Do you still enter in manually?
No, okay. I don't. Well, I did for about a month.
Awesome.
The first month I was okay. manually entering
okay.
all the stuff by hand.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, the walk boxes in the new system for Thimbleweed Park, and they're still walk boxes, but they can now just be incited polygons.
Right, right.
Right. They don't have to be, you know, squares
yeah.
or even trapezoids. They can just
yeah.
be anything that we can really twist
yeah.
around,
yeah.
you know, the objects.
Yeah.
And then, you know, at runtime, you know, it'll kind of split the, you know, those polygons up into, you know, little triangles and stuff. To
okay.
make the,
so you like do a generic kind of polygon thing mm-hmm. that you can make whatever you want.
Right.
This is the walkable area.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will go ahead and tessellate that for you.
Exactly.
And also figure out the connectivity that
yeah.
we used to do by hand. And then,
yeah.
then from there, the system is pretty similar?
Yeah, then it's actually very similar
okay.
at that point. You know, the stuff that happens under the hood is very similar. It's just we've removed that kind of human step. That's just all done by, you know, robots.
All right, so let me check how much time we got here. I don't actually know. So 5:18, I don't even know, my handwriting is so bad that I can't even read what I wrote down. Let's see. Yeah, it's definitely not handwriting hero. So this is 5:20, it says. I think we don't have to, so correct me if I'm wrong, but this was 5:35 that I was supposed to write down here, right? So we have easily probably 20 or 30 minutes left. So this is pretty good. Okay. All right. So I guess I just kind of want to drill down on a couple things here that we sort of already talked about, but that are maybe a little bit more processy, let's say. So you now have a situation, and I guess this would have been true, for example, going back to something like Secret of Monkey Island 2 or something, where you actually have a fair number of people working on this game, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like there's a lot of rooms to create, there's a lot of objects, a lot of scripts to write, and that sort of stuff. So what's the process like, you know, what's the tool set like for building this? Like walk boxes, for example,
mm-hmm.
right? Do you tend to do a lot of like rolling tools as necessary? Like, was this a thing where, you know, I'm maybe Maniac Mansion, I put in the coordinates by hand or something, and then later on we make a tool for drawing? Like, can you tell me a little bit about like the tooling up process
mm-hmm.
as you sort of, you know, go through the various games? Especially because now I know you guys had like hot loading on a VAX or whatever. I just want to know like what did it actually look like to make this thing? Because you know there's a couple different levels. And at the same token, you were entering walkbox things by hand. So I have no
right.
idea. I can't even
yeah,
guess
yeah, yeah,
where
yeah.
things would fall on your tooling level, if that makes sense.
Yeah, we had to, you know, by the time Monkey Island rolled around,
yeah.
and really that was because, you know, by the time Monkey Island rolled around, we were working on PCs,
okay.
right? We weren't working on Commodores anymore, so we
okay.
had a lot more. We weren't working on the VAX machines at
okay.
that point. You know, at that point, we were doing our coding and compiling on the PCs that we were running, you know, running the games on. And
were you still able to retain sort of the hot loading stuff when you moved?
Not as nicely.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
okay.
a lot of that stuff went away. You
was
know,
that difficult?
You know, not really, just
okay.
because there were so many other benefits. You
okay.
know, when you're working on a Commodore 64 with 19K of heap space,
yeah.
you know, when you have suddenly 120K of heap space
okay.
on a PC, it's, you know, it's like nirvana, right? So I think, you know, you're kind of happy to leave some of that stuff, you know, on,
okay.
on the roadside. So, you know, tool-wise, we did have tools. We had our own animation tool that we did.
Okay.
That was, and we had our own character editor tool, and
okay.
we had our own room layout tool. So the
okay.
the tool that we laid out rooms was called phlegm. Everything followed the scum.
Okay.
We had to, like, phlegm and mucus and bile.
Oh, God.
And yeah, those were
okay.
all the tool names.
Okay.
So,
all right.
You know, phlegm was the tool that you lay the rooms out in. And, you know, that basically would bring the art in. All the art was done in D-Paint.
Okay.
And so that would just bring in these, you know, .lbm rooms from
yeah.
D-Paint, and it would load them in. And then you could go through, you know, with your cursor, and you would tag the objects. on the screen.
Okay.
And you would lay down the walk boxes.
Got
so
it.
That was all done visually.
Okay.
You know, in
so there's basically like a markup process that happens in there. And so what does that look like today? So for Thimbleby Park, similar, different?
I'm probably the most unoriginal person in the world. I built a tool that you bring in Photoshop files and you mark objects and you lay down lockboxes. So
it's like, it is exactly the same process.
Yeah, it is.
Well, hey man, if it works,
it
right?
It works, yeah.
Okay, and so what sorts of stuff happened, and maybe the answer is people just got really good at it or what, but what sort of stuff happened once you start expanding, even perhaps on Maniac Mansion, I don't know, but obviously it probably didn't have much you could do about it, but maybe later on. You know, that scripting sort of system and like the Scum VM and all that stuff, like you're starting to make a significant chunk of what happens in the game is going through this system. Mm-hmm. It becomes hard with no tools perhaps to debug problems, like because we don't know, you know, why did the clock stop ticking? We don't know, right? Mm-hmm. At what point or, you know, did you start having or did you ever have like tools for looking at that? Was there inspection, that sort of stuff? How did, like, what did that sort of look like?
Yeah, I mean, once we didn't have the Unix machines where we could, you know, look at all the memory, you know, we had to do that on the PC.
Okay, so tell me a little about that. So on the Unix machines, you would actually just sort of freeze the Commodore 64's execution and just, you just inspect the memory yourself?
You inspect the memory, yeah. And
okay.
I mean, that was pretty crude.
Okay.
But by the time that the PC version came about, you know, we all had kind of second monitors. You know, we bought like, you know, cheap black and white Hercules monitors.
Okay.
And so we had, you know, the main PC thing, we had a secondary, you know, black and white monitor, which we did all the debugging in.
Okay.
And, you know, at that point we could do source level debugging.
Okay.
So, you know, we could stop and we could single step and the source code would just show up on the secondary monitor and we could just, you know, step through the lines of the source code.
So you actually had fairly, that's on Maniac Mansion even?
No.
Or
no,
that's
Maniac
okay, because Mansion never shipped
that.
On the PC?
Yeah,
or,
we never had that on Maniac.
Okay, so that was on Monkey Island or?
Yeah, it started with Loom and then.
Oh, okay, started with Loom.
Yeah, Loom was really the first full PC game that we had done.
Okay, and so at that point you guys decided, hey, we should probably have a debugger for this stuff.
Yeah.
There's so much, it's hard to like actually figure out what's going on in the scripts.
Right.
Let's do it here. Mm-hmm. Thimbleweed Park.
I don't have a source level debugger.
Okay.
And that's one thing I don't have that I hope to write, you know, someday so I can do that. The debugging is a lot easier. I mean, the language is a lot more dynamic.
Okay.
So, you know, there is like a little debug window which I can actually type in commands, you know, actual language commands, you know, call functions, change variables and do all that.
And you have some kind of dumping, I assume, so you can like print out this object so you kind of inspect.
Yeah, it's back to printf debugging, right? I mean,
yeah.
That's kind of how you do this.
Okay. Stuff. So basically, like, in some sense, now in Thimbleweed Park, you rely on, I guess that's typically called like a top level or something like this, people call it, like the ability to type in code dynamically gives you the ability to sort of like, okay, well, I can go in and if I'm wondering why something's doing something, I can print out some of the state, or I can also kind of twiddle with things and see if that
you can change
was what it was.
You can
or
just call functions to, you know, kick the game into a certain state or whatnot.
And do you do a lot of the stuff on Thimbleweed Park in terms of creating those scripts, or do you like do you have people who are doing game scripting? Is it more similar to like the Monkey Island case where it's like
there's
people doing scripting and you're doing the engine?
Yeah, there's one other person, David Fox, and you know coincidentally he was the other scripter on Maniac Mansion.
Okay.
Right.
So it's exactly the team because Gary Winnick was the artist of Maniac Mansion.
Right, and I'm
you're
doing the engine and scripting, and David is doing the scripting. It's like we're all just older,
and
you know, it's really. You know, about it.
Okay.
So you know, he does probably the bulk of the scripting. You know,
I
my time is probably split between, you know, building the engine and doing scripting stuff. Although most of my scripting tends to be more experimental stuff. It's like I'll add some new feature, and so I'll program a part of the game that needs that feature.
To see.
Where David will then kind of go off and do more of the nuts and bolts. Scripting.
So are there any new features in the VM that you're using now, that you built now, that were like very different from the Scum way? Like was there anything, or is it like, no, like it is basically Scum, like I just kind of did, you know, a new take on, you know, the exact same thing, or was there like, have you experimented, because especially when you say experimental scripting for features, are those just features that used to be in Scum that you haven't implemented in yours yet, or are those new features where you're like, I think it would be nice if adventure game scripting languages had this?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of new features just to make, you know, in the language, just coding things, you know, functions we can call. You know, the game is all kind of, you know, classic 8-bit, you know, art stuff, except we have shaders, right?
Okay,
we
okay.
can do lighting,
okay.
right? So the lights in the world actually project light
okay.
know, out, and they actually shade the characters as they walk around.
I see.
And so, you know, there's stuff like that that's kind of new.
Okay.
And, you know, so, you know, I create commands in the language to be able to control the lights, because we
see.
Want the lights to be able to blink on and off
right,
and
right.
do all these other things. So it's just tying, you know, all of these new, you know, features that we have in the engine back into the scripting language and how all that kind of stuff works.
But what if the charm of old adventure games was that they didn't have lighting? you're ruining that one, you know, you never know, right? It's like, I guess there was some, though, I guess.
Well, I mean, when I did the Kickstarter, it's like my goal was, it wasn't to make a classic adventure game the way they were.
Yeah.
It was to make a classic adventure game the way you remember them.
Okay,
right?
I see.
Because people don't remember those games exactly like they were,
I
right?
See.
They kind of extrapolate the graphics out to much better than they really
I
were.
See.
And so I wanted to be able to kind of remain true and pure to the 8-bit stuff.
I see.
But I'm not opposed to using shaders
I see.
To get some really nice, you know, subtle lighting effects on everything, because I think that's the way people remembered those games
okay.
you know,
I
in
see.
Their heads.
And that makes sense. So it's kind of like saying, We're trying to reproduce your memory of Monkey Island, not the actual
yes,
Monkey Island, because the
exactly.
actual Monkey Island, you might be like, that doesn't look so
yeah,
good.
Exactly.
Right, or something. And so we want to take that away. So it's
yeah.
got to walk, I guess, almost like a fine line between, it can't look like a completely modern game, because then it obviously isn't Monkey Island, but we can't go all the way back to exactly what it looked like, because it's too far. So you're kind
right.
of like in this middle ground of trying to like nail. What did you remember?
Right.
It's
the feeling.
It's the feeling
of playing those games, and you know, we can certainly do a little more with the hardware. You know, I can actually do scaling, you know, through the GPU, and I can do stuff like that now that you know, we couldn't do back then.
What's your approach been to, this is kind of a little off topic, but I just kind of realized I hadn't even written this down. What's your approach been to music over time? Because I feel like, you know, in sort of the, I want to say Monkey Island 2, maybe. It kind of had very, very advanced interactive music for its
yeah,
time period,
the
right?
iMuse system.
Yeah, the iMuse thing, and then like, I don't really know what you guys did with the Humongous titles necessarily, because a lot of those actually featured more heavily sort of recorded, like produced stuff, which mm-hmm. couldn't probably be so interactive. But what was your feeling about those? Was that something you really weren't that interested in anyway, and maybe some other people went off and did it, or did you care a lot about the music? And what's your approach to it now? Can you give me, yeah, like I said, this was never on the list, but I just kind of thought of it and I was like, should ask.
Well, I mean, the iMuse system, which did probably one of the most amazing interactive music systems I've ever seen.
Okay.
And it was amazing, and it was incredible to work in. It was time consuming.
Okay.
I mean, we had, you know, one whole game scripter who did nothing but hook in all the music keys
really?
For stuff for Monkey Island 2. So, you know, it was intensive to
yeah.
do that kind of stuff. But iMuse really became not possible with the whole digital revolution of stuff, because iMuse was still just playing notes,
MIDI,
you know,
yeah.
on MIDI cards and whatever.
Yeah.
And when digital music hit the scene, it really couldn't do what iMuse did
yeah.
anymore. And so I think it just kind of lost a little bit of that stuff. But, you know, the music in Thimbleweed Park, I kind of describe as fully modern.
Okay.
I'm not a big fan of, like, chiptunes, and
okay.
I'm not
okay.
a big fan of that stuff.
Okay.
And so I felt like music kind of embodies such kind of an emotional tone for
okay.
the game that I really just wanted the music to be full and really nice and really good music for the game.
And do you think that, like, so is that something that's kind of missing nowadays in some sense? Would you say, like your description of the iMuse
mm-hmm.
system, or I guess the results of the iMuse system, and having gone to digital and sort of losing most of that,
mm-hmm.
is that something that you think we kind of need to get back at some point, like as a technological problem? Like what? Or do you think that games don't really suffer much from not having that technology? Like, what's your take on it as someone who's made games with and without it?
Yeah, I think really sadly, I think music is kind of ignored for the
okay.
most part
okay.
in games.
And okay.
and it's too bad that it is. I mean, I'm not a music person. I know
okay.
nothing about music, right?
Sure.
I do not play an instrument.
Yeah.
I couldn't name the notes for
okay.
you, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I kind of entrust that there are other people that do that kind of stuff really well. But I really enjoyed working with the IMU system. I enjoy kind of interactive music, you know, the thing about the music in Monkey Island 2 and the IMU system was that was one continuous piece of music from the time the game started until the game ended. But as you kind of move through the world, it just slowly changed to match the different rooms you were in, the different areas of the game you were in, and it was seamless and flawless. And I miss that.
Yeah. Right?
I like having that nonstop music going on, but it does need to emotionally change as you work your way through the world.
Yeah.
And it just needs to happen very subtly so you don't realize that it's changing.
So what's your approach in Thimbleweed Park to this? You just kind of blend between pieces or?
The approach that we're using in Thimbleweed Park is the musician is writing a whole lot of these little 10-second little pieces of music. Okay. And he's writing them so they can chain, so the end of one piece can chain to the beginning of, you know, virtually any other piece. And I just have these pools of music and I can just switch pools. And so the most that you'll lag is 10 seconds while it kind of finishes one piece and then transitions into another piece.
So
it can do just kind of wall-to-wall music.
That's not that far off from iMuse then, in some sense.
It's not. I mean,
it's getting some of it back.
iMuse could do it on a note-by-note
note
level,
right? Yes, yeah.
Where here I'm kind of chunked into the 10 seconds.
But so in some sense, you are, I guess, trying to sort of recapture that same feel.
Bit,
because obviously, you know, you could have done something where it's like I fade one out and fade the other one in, right?
Right,
so you're actually kind of going to a certain distance that actually many games don't go. Like many games actually will not have music that can change in that way. They just kind of like fade in and out things or, you know, abruptly stop.
Yeah, and it's what we're trying. I don't know how successful it'll be, but I mean, it's a lot of work for the musician, right?
Yes,
because
that's true.
Has to make sure that a whole bunch of pieces can kind of chain into other pieces.
Yeah, without there being too much abruptness. And you have to kind of carry over. Yeah.
So it's a lot of work on his part to do.
All right. Well, that's actually very interesting. I didn't know that. Let's see how we're doing on time. So I think we're kind of getting to where we should probably start wrapping up. I think I got, actually, most of the things that I wanted to ask, but I will point out the fact that earlier in the day, when Mike Acton was up here, he wanted to know if creating cutscenes had always been a problem, and he wanted to hear that from the person who... Did you guys even coin that phrase?
Yes.
I want to say you're like the people who introduced the phrase cutscene.
It is true. Yes.
So tell me a little. Well, first, we might as well, since this is entirely self-indulgent for me, tell me how that comes about. Like, games don't have cutscenes, and now they do. What happened?
I mean, games had interstitials.
Yeah.
Right? Games had little canned animated sequences. That was not something we created. Yeah. The word cutscene, that was something that we definitely coined, and it came from, in Maniac Mansion, you'd be playing the game, and the game would literally just cut away and show you what was happening in Dr. Fred's lab, or Nurse Edna's room, or Weird Ed's room, or something, and, I mean, it did it very crudely, in the fact that there was just a little timer running. And, you know, when 18 minutes expired, it would just, no matter what you were doing, right, you could be right in the middle of solving some really important puzzle and we just cut away, right?
Gotcha.
And so they were scenes that cut away from the game.
Yes.
So they were called cutscenes. And there was even a command in the Scum language called cutscene.
Okay.
And it was a very sophisticated command in that when you'd run a cutscene, it would kind of save the game state away,
right,
go off and do the cutscene, and when the cutscene ended, it would just automatically restore the game state to where you were before.
So it kind of takes the VM's state at this time, dumps it, go load this entire other state, and then as soon as we're done, it's kind of like a you know, an excursion, if you will, where it's like, and then we're just going to like full on romp over that with the new thing.
Yes.
Okay. So that's actually probably one of the harder things to implement in Scum, because everything has to work right through that pipeline.
Yeah, that was definitely a sophisticated yet really powerful feature that the language had.
So Mike wants to know, were cutscenes always a problem? Like our cutscenes, I guess implementing them was, but I mean for the artist creating them and that sort of stuff.
No, they weren't a problem.
Okay.
Because they
you're doing something wrong. I don't know what to say, but somewhere between Monkey Island and
hit
here.
Hit me up after the talk, I'll straighten you out. They weren't a problem because they were all hand-coded.
Right.
Right. That we didn't have a tool that we built these cutscenes on. If we needed Nurse Edna to walk around the room while she was saying something, we literally had code that walked her here, then walked her there. So we didn't have that same, you know, asset export problem that, you know, cutscenes have today because, you know, they're coming out of these big tools.
Is that so? I should ask that actually about the sort of, we talked about the multiprocessing thing. And creating cutscenes and that sort of stuff, because my recollection, again, and it's been a very long time, I guess, since I played it, but my recollection, even in Monkey Island, but I think almost certainly in Monkey Island 2, there were definitely places where and putting away sort of what your definition of cutscene was there, there's definitely places where scripted sorts of things happened in conjunction with the player still having the freedom to do things, right? Mm-hmm. So there were times when something relatively elaborate, like this guy is going to go walk off the screen and go somewhere, you didn't actually freeze the entire player's ability to do stuff. I remember there being some concurrency there, even, like I said, as early as Monkey Island. And maybe that's my memory being bad, but that's my recollection.
That's correct. That is correct.
What did that kind of look like at that time? Because, you know, that's sort of a really hard problem, especially, you know, again, when you're talking about a very limited system that has a lot of constraints to even just do the basic stuff it does. Now we're talking about sort of the sort of thing that was like, you know, Half-Life 2 was struggling to do these sorts of things, right? So we're talking about how do we have the ability to script something that has to happen, but we don't really know what the player was doing at this time. Was that something that you guys thought a lot about, or was it just because, hey, we tried to keep it so that it really wouldn't be a problem, or what? Like, what was that like at the time? Because that was a really early attempt to do something like this, and it went surprisingly well.
It's a really hard problem because, you know, I think players intrinsically just want to fuck up everything you're doing, right? They just do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's not that we could have the scene where, you know, you're following the shopkeeper into the forest to find the swordmaster. We really couldn't plan that the player was going to do exactly what we wanted them to do.
Yes.
Follow behind him, you know, stay in the back. No, it's not what players do. And players want to run up in front of him.
Yeah,
they want
to
do all of these things. So, yeah, I mean, we had to do with it. We had to deal with all that stuff. And I think, you know, the way we solved a lot of that stuff is you just cheat as much as you can.
Okay.
You know, so when the shopkeeper is walking from his store to the swordmaster, he's not literally walking through those rooms, right? He walks to the door and he leaves, and then we just kind of do a little bit of timer stuff. There's just a timer running. And so when you walk into the next room, we just put the shopkeeper close to the exit and just have him walk off the screen. Right?
So you can't possibly catch him or whatever.
And if the timer went too far, then you just lost him and he didn't appear.
I see.
So it's all about just creating weird little shortcuts and cheating your way through the problem as much as you can.
Well, I think we are just about out of time. Yep, we are. So thank you so much. That was that was extremely enjoyable for me. Those are like so many things I wanted to know. But thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks.